Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Each episode of Keep Calm and Cook On features a meaningful interview and answers to listeners' questions about cooking. Thank you to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools that I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. My guest this week is Asha Gomez, the Indian-born and Atlanta-based chef and cookbook author. In her work, Asha continuously explores her two Souths, the area of southern India where she's from and the area of the American South where she calls home. We recorded a conversation last month at the Third Space. It's her venue that is sort of a restaurant, home kitchen, classroom, party space, all in one. It's the space she built on her own terms, and it's also where she shows us what's possible if we think outside of the box. We talked about how she figured out what worked for her first by figuring out what didn't, and we also talk about the perception and the misconception of Indian food in America. Our conversation closes on Asha's advocacy work and finding the power of her own voice. Needless to say, we covered a lot in a short period of time. She's someone I really look to and look up to, and I'm so happy to get to know better, and I hope you do too. Will you introduce yourself?
So my name is Asha Gomez. I am a chef, a cookbook author, and I curate a space called The Third Space in Atlanta, Georgia.
And can we talk a little bit about this space?
Sure.
This is a very special space.
So I realized really early in my career that I did not want to be in a restaurant environment. It was just not suited for me and who I am as a person. So I wanted to have a space where I could create experiences for people. Mm-hmm. So I kind of built my dream kitchen called The Third Space. It seats 38 people comfortably. And I don't do any dinners that are over 38. I have about two dinners a month that are open to the public. Outside of that, I do a lot of private events in the space.
And so this space very much exists on your own terms.
Very much. So I work when I want to. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be sitting at a restaurant day in and day out. It's an environment that is, first of all, it's financially sustainable. It's a sustainable model. It allows me to have a certain quality of life, not just from a time perspective, but also from a financial mm-hmm. perspective, because the model financially makes more sense than a traditional restaurant does.
And how is that? Can you break that down a little bit?
I think your profit margins in a restaurant are usually around 11% if you're lucky. In this environment, it's over 60% on your profit margin. Over 60% on your profit margin. Because you don't have the traditional overheads of labor and food cost mm-hmm. like you would in a traditional restaurant. All our events are pre-ticketed, pre-booked. We know exactly who's showing up. So we have no wastage. We literally, it's me and Tiffany, who's my right hand here. We're a two-woman show. And then when we actually do have our dinners, we have servers who are on our roster. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm able to take really good care of my employees from a financial perspective. Because my profit margins are mm-hmm. higher, I'm able to take care of my staff really well. So I never have an issue finding someone to be in the space. Like Tiffany has been with me forever, you know. And
yeah.
This is the only job she has. But it's a sustainable model for mm-hmm. her as well.
Yeah, I feel like what you've built here sort of works for everyone involved. Like
it
your customers, for you, for your employees, you know, and on
yes.
and on.
When other chefs come and they rent this space, it's kind of all-inclusive. So there's plating for up to five courses in the mm-hmm. space. There's stemware, there's glassware, there's silverware, there's napkins. So everything that you would need to actually have a full service if you were doing a pop-up. you'd have to rent all mm-hmm. these things. You know, it's kind of a one-stop shop.
Yeah.
You can come and the chef can actually just enjoy cooking.
Yeah.
And
how about that?
Yes. And it's such a personal, intimate experience because your guest, it's an open kitchen. Mm-hmm. So your guests are watching you cook. They're watching you plate. And so many times I'll have, you know, I encourage guests to come stand behind the kitchen counter with me. I have guests that will come and help me start. When they see I have 30 plates out, they'll like come and help me plate. So it's really an intimate experience. And by the time, you know, 25, 35 strangers walk into an environment, they commune over something that's special, and 25, 35 friends walk out because they have enjoyed this environment that is so non-traditional, but it's community at its best around a table.
That's amazing. And I just want to back up a little bit to, you know, what inspired you to open this space, because you had been through experiences that didn't feel this good. Like, I feel like you have built something that is so special and that really works because you were also part of things that didn't feel
absolutely.
So good. Yeah.
So I'm not a classically trained chef. I didn't know anything about the restaurant business. I kind of fell upon the food world. So my career actually started in skincare.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing skincare for 20 years. And I...
You do glow.
Thank you. I practice a science called Ayurveda, which is a 5,000-year-old science of life in India. And so when you practice Ayurveda, when you do treatments, you have to touch all the senses. So it's the visual aspect, it's the, you know, it's the sense when you walk into an environment, it's touch. And I realized that in traditional spas here, the one thing that they weren't doing was they weren't actually touching your palate. And so my spa actually had a built-in kitchen, and every treatment ended with the meal I had cooked for my guests.
Wow.
So I did that for years. It was a very successful business.
So you owned your own spa.
I did.
Yeah.
But it was an ultra luxury product. And in 2008, when the economy crashed, I was a casualty of the times. The last thing people were thinking about was spending that kind of money on spa treatments. It was around the time I'd adopted my son from India, so mm-hmm. I was blissfully being a mom. But I was getting so many requests from my clients about my food and not so much about when I was going to open my next spa, which kind of threw me off a little bit. I said, this is so interesting.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, do a supper club just, you know, for fun. For fun, I was going to have 12 people around my table, and I'll do one or two dinners, and, you know, it's going to go away. Well, at my first dinner, for some reason, I ended up having a journalist from Delta Sky, another local Atlanta journalist, and they ended up being journalists at the table for that first supper club. And it led to me doing supper clubs practically every other week, to the point that by the end of the year, I was renting the Macy's downtown atrium.
Oh my gosh.
Doing supper clubs with 200 people.
Wow.
Who were sitting on the floor eating out of banana leaves with their hands, Americans, Kerala cuisine. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, is this the next trajectory for me? And it was. It ended up becoming a brick and mortar. What I did not understand at the point was the rigor of what it takes to run a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And the toll that it takes on you on a personal level, on your family life, and also how financially straining it was. I would wake up every 2 weeks before payroll and be like, oh my God, I have to write $30,000 in payroll checks, you know, literally waking up in cold sweats. And then you have like 50 tickets in front of you every night, you
mm-hmm.
know, and you realize, wow, this is a pressure-filled environment. And I lost my joy for cooking because it was constantly so stressed. So at the peak, and, you know, Cardamom Hill got nominated its first year out for a James Beard for best new restaurant in the country. I mean, it was just getting accolades.
Mm-hmm.
From all over because the cuisine was so different. But I was not finding any gratification in any of it. And so I decided that it was not my path and that I needed to do something where I could regain my joy of cooking. And so I thought a little bit outside the box, and that's how Third Space came about.
In that kind of time of that transition of really, you know, seeing yourself wake up during the middle of the night, having this kind of palpable anxiety, knowing that you weren't feeling joyful about the food you were making, and then, you know, making the decision to transition. How long of a period of time was that?
It was a good year in the making.
Yeah.
Because then it was, this kind of model didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It was just in my mind's eye, right? So even creating a space like this was so unconventional. Would it be successful? Would it not? But as far as I was concerned, I wanted to create a space where I found joy in my work. You know, I read a very long time ago this one sentence by Khalil Gibran, and it was like, work is love made visible. And I have always tried to have my work be just that, because then work becomes joyful and it doesn't feel like work anymore. And so I wanted to be able to create a space where that's what the space exuded and that's what I was feeling, that I was feeling love when I cooked. And that's how this came about. I just thought in a very unconventional way. And took a little bit of courage to do it.
For sure.
But it's worked.
Yeah.
It's worked for me.
And so would you say joy is like your driving motivator?
It always has been. I think life can be very, very stressful. And, you know, most of the stress, I think, outside of health issues, I think most of the stress that people face happen to be financially related, right? So how do you create a business model that's financially sustainable that can alleviate a part of that stress? And it's very difficult to do that in the restaurant business. So it was trial and error, but it's doable.
Yeah.
And it's sustainable, which makes it even more joyful.
Yeah, no, it's rare to find something that sounds as appealing as what you've built here at the Third Space that's also, you know, financially sustainable. And I feel like you've really proven that it can work.
And it can.
It's amazing to me that you built it without having seen it done. And so what was guiding you while you were building it?
A space that I found joyful.
And just trusting that.
Just trusting that. A lot of it was trusting my own intuition, my own gut, and knowing that I could create this space for myself, but also had the advantage of now having had some notoriety in the industry. So, you know, could I have created this model without first actually being in the restaurant business and, you know, having gotten the accolades that I got? Probably not. I do believe that it was a path that I had to take to get to this place, because who would know me in this environment if not? But the restaurant business had given me a spotlight. You know, people had written about me, people knew me, people wanted to eat my food. So I did have that advantage going into this model. That, you know, that's why it made more sense. If this was the model I created from the beginning, I don't know if people would have taken to it as much as had I not gone through that path.
Yeah, it's good to keep in mind. I'm wondering, when you had the restaurant and you had so many accolades and people were writing about you and you're nominated, you know, for this and that, and these things that so many people, I think, you know, from the outside, it seems so, that's what you want. That is what is glamorous and what is desirable. And, but it was leaving you, you know, waking up from bouts of anxiety. And so what, I guess my question is, how do you define success? What does that look like for you now? What are the things that you desire and that feel good when you achieve them?
For me, success is, I have to say financial stability is important. Success is the time that I get to spend with my son today. Success is the joy that I feel when I walk into the third space. Success is the joy that I see my clients and my guests have when they walk in this space and walk out of this space. To me, those are the true definitions of success in my life as I live it today, is finding joy in the everyday. Mm. You know, I'm not waiting to go on vacation to find my joy.
Sure.
I want to find it in my moments every single day.
Yeah.
And work is a huge aspect of that. And so creating an environment where I can have that every day was very important for me.
Yeah, you're living it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. And I think it's so important for other people, especially who are in, you know, restaurant jobs or running restaurants, who are not feeling great.
Yeah.
I think it's important to hear that that's just even possible. Not that they have to do it, but that it's possible.
Yes, because it's such a stressful, it's a high pressure environment. Mm-hmm. You literally, sometimes you walk into kitchens and it's like this pressure cooker,
yeah.
Right? It's and you know, hats off to my friends who do it day in and day out with so much passion and so much love. And a lot of times I think it is their path, mm-hmm. you know, because they find joy in it.
Sure.
That high pressure is something that people thrive on.
Yeah.
It just wasn't something that I thrived
yeah.
on.
Yeah. Yeah. A big part of what you do here, from what I gather, is you teach a lot of classes.
I do teach.
Do you like teaching?
I love teaching.
Yeah.
It's,
what do you love about it?
I love introducing... I think it's probably my immigrant experience that makes me love teaching, because most of the people that sit at my, that come into this space are, you know, it's so diverse. Mm-hmm. It's the America that I live, love, laugh, play in, work in. And I'm able to touch somebody's everyday experience in their home, around their tables, with their families and their children, by introducing another region of the world to them. Mm-hmm. And that to me is very exciting, because I am sharing my immigrant experience, and I am teaching people to be more acceptable of other cultures through food. I say it all the time, like with Ethan, with my son Ethan, I expose him to cuisines around the world. I do travel a lot mm-hmm. with Ethan. I try to take him to different countries as much as I can. But there are places that I can't take him to. And I actually, my introduction to those countries to him is through food. Mm-hmm. And so he has this tremendous respect for the global community, and it's through food.
Yeah.
So... teaching someone how to use a spice they've never used before, how they can incorporate it into their kitchens on an everyday. I love it.
Yeah. Well, it opens up the whole world. It reminds me, there was a line that I wrote down. So I think a lot of people might be familiar with you from the Times article that that Kim Severson wrote about you. And there's a line where you said, "Not all Indian food belongs on a buffet line at $4.99. Indian food is 5,000 years of tradition and history, and it belongs right up there with French cuisine." So I'm assuming that's something
yes.
you still very much believe.
Very much so.
And is that kind of feeling what you're describing, you know, exposing your son to, teaching your students about different spices and everything, just kind of opening up this whole entire, you know, world of Indian food? Is
yes.
that a driving force as well behind?
Very much so. It's connecting the dots for mm-hmm. people. I think the advantage that we as chefs and cookbook authors have today is that we're storytellers, mm-hmm. right? And people love I think people love connecting through stories. And so every plate or every dish I put, I always say, you know, what I put on a plate is a sum total of my life experiences. Mm. The kitchens I've been fortunate enough to cook with, be there in the Indian South, the American South, the countries I've been fortunate enough to call my home. These are, you know, these are all the things that factor into what I put on a plate. So it's so personal. It's literally my life and my life experiences that show up on a plate. For me, these are really trying times mm-hmm. in our country. And I have realized that we all have a part to play in contributing to making people understand the true American immigrant experience. And I do it through food on an everyday basis with whoever I touch, whether it's over a cup of chai that I share with them or a buttermilk biscuit that I share with them, but showing them the humanity of the fact that we are indeed all one. But for some reason, I feel that food connects us on a deeper level. You can, whether you're sitting with family or you're sitting with a total stranger across a table and sharing a meal, something happens in that moment, and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's community at its best. So, you know, whether it's my home kitchen or this kitchen, I have an open kitchen in my home. Like, literally, my neighbors can walk in anytime and ask me for a cup of tea, and it'll get, you know, I'll start brewing a cup of tea. It's because I've personally taken it upon myself that every person's perception that I can change of an immigrant and the immigrant experience, I will do it on an everyday basis. Mm-hmm. And I think more of us need to do that.
Yeah.
You know, we can talk all we want and we can bicker and complain all we want, but the everyday experiences and the everyday interactions that you have with your fellow Americans are really truly what are going to change people's perceptions.
I'm just nodding so much. I really agree. And I, not that they're the same by any means, but I find my own parallels in my own life just through being a gay woman and trying to use my work in food and in cookbooks to kind of normalize that experience.
Absolutely.
To show that it, you know, it's not scary.
It's
you know,
not.
I cook for my wife just as you cook for your spouse, or, you know, whatever it might be. So not to make it about me, but I think it's important
it's about
to kind
of
make
of us,
these connections. Yeah. There's a moment I'm thinking about where I think you did such a great job of illustrating that and doing it with some humor. And that was the, you know, however long, maybe 10 minutes that you were on the fried chicken episode of David Chang's Netflix show,
yes.
Ugly Delicious. And I loved when you made your fried chicken for him and kind of pointed out, you know, that people around the world have known forever that if you season,
if you dredge a bird in flour
and fry it,
and you deep fry it, it's going to be good.
Yeah.
Everybody figured that out.
And it was,
yes.
It was humorous, but it was also like, we have more in common than the other way
we
around.
Do.
But our differences are also what make things interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I thought that was such a tremendous moment.
And, you know, like connecting even the regions of the world that you live in. I've been fortunate enough, you know, when you think about the Indian South, it's kind of on the equator belt. And you think about the American South, there's some aspect of it that falls around that, you know, circle on the globe. And you, the same kinds of produce are kind of grown here. Rice is common in the South. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a region of the world where rice was a predominant crop. And you start finding all these similarities just based on where you're strategically placed in the world. And you realize you have so much in common. And especially if you come from places like port cities, like, you know, you think of Charleston and Savannah. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a port city, in Kerala, all the external influences that come into port cities are fascinating. This is why cuisines in those regions are so amazing, because so much came to those shores.
Sure.
And so, through trade and commerce, so much happened in those places that it defined the cuisine of that region. And I find tremendous similarities in these two regions that are, you know, continents and oceans apart, and yet I'm able to find commonality in these two places. And I think when you start connecting the dots for people, all of a sudden, it resonates with them. All of a sudden, you know, $4.99 on a buffet line, you understand why it would bother someone like me. You're willing to sit at my table and pay a premium dollar like you would my fellow American chef. You know, I'm sourcing from the same places he's sourcing. My heritage and my history and my culture is just as rich. I took just as much time to create and put thought into a dish to bring it to the table. And, you know, none of this would happen if we don't have these conversations and we don't help people connect the dots. So it's constant conversation. Yeah. And yeah, and that's part of the teaching for me is even when I'm teaching a class, I'm actually teaching people to see the similarities that we have. And even if we don't, there are ingredients that we have that are indigenous to these regions that are similar. We may cook them differently, but ingredients are similar. Like, for example, the one thing that was shocking to me when I started cooking Southern food was I grew up in my mother's kitchen where she would have this block of jaggery sitting on mm-hmm. the, you know, in a gunny bag. And so anytime she wanted to sweeten something, she would shave it and she would melt it and it would be used as a sweetener. And the syrup that I used for my fried chicken is actually made with jaggery. And John T from SFA sat at my table once and he goes, wow, this is so similar to an ingredient in the American South. I'm going to send you a bottle one of these days. And a week later, this bottle showed up in my kitchen, and it was cane syrup. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially the same thing, yeah. You know. It's the jaggery melted down is essentially mm-hmm. cane syrup. So I started finding those, like people started pointing them mm-hmm. out. I started realizing there's just such a deep connection in these two regions. But yeah, I don't know why I went off on that tangent.
That's okay.
But yeah.
I mean, it makes me think too, just being in the American South, one example that I always find to be so powerful is grits and polenta.
Yes.
I mean, they're the same thing.
Yep. And for us, upma.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We semolina, mm-hmm. we cook semolina
yeah.
and we make it pretty,
yeah.
I mean, we add ginger and my mom would add ginger and raisins and mustard seeds to it. But it's essentially, when you think about it texturally, it's mm-hmm. kind of, yeah.
Yeah. And then what, you know, what one person can charge for exactly. one of those things in a restaurant versus another.
Someone else, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. What do you think when I say the words curry powder? What comes to mind?
Misconception. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to any Indian home, any Indian market, there is going to be no package mm-hmm. that says curry powder. Mm-hmm. It's non-existent in Indian cuisine. When we say curry, it's two or more spices mm-hmm. that are cooked in some kind of sauce that make a curry. There are tens of thousands of variations of curries. I think curry powder is more maybe Caribbean. Mm. Maybe some part of Europe, but it's not Indian. Mm-hmm. Curry is Indian. Curry powder isn't Indian. But curry is really just it's a sauce that, like I said, tens of thousands yeah. of ways that you can make that sauce.
Yeah. So it's like saying salsa
exactly.
in Mexico or, yeah. I think it's important to clarify. It's a misconception is the first thing that comes. I wanted to just sort of end by talking about your advocacy work, because you do amazing advocacy work. And is it true that it was kind of inspired by your son? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So most of the advocacy work I do revolves around issues that revolve around malnutrition mm-hmm. and hunger. One in every 9 of us in the world goes to bed hungry at night. And it's not for a lack of food in the world. It's just that today food is used as a weapon of war. So most places that do deal with hunger, it is conflict regions mm-hmm. in the world, really. We have made tremendous strides in trying to alleviate it as much as we can, but sometimes just getting access to get the food to somebody is the issue. It's not that we don't have it.
It's access.
And yes, the other issue is we have very antiquated laws when it comes to food aid. For example, the U.S., I think we have about $1 billion in food aid. And to this day, if there's a famine somewhere, you know, we are now shipping surplus, which we don't have, we had it at one point, grain, across oceans and continents, which takes 3 months to get to someplace, and we pay 50 cents on the dollar to ship it. Which really, you know, just it doesn't make sense. It's just so antiquated. Mm-hmm. But shipping companies make money. And so the lobby groups for the shipping companies are really, really strong. And that's why these laws don't get changed, because then, you know, it's the lobbyist. On the other hand, if you actually went to a region closer to where the famine was, there's food somewhere in that region. You can get the food there faster, and you can't just go dump food somewhere, right? You're shutting down their economic systems. You have to keep their commerce going. So we're not helping them any by transporting food from here to there. Really, the thing to do is to find food at a closer source, let those farmers still have revenue sources, and so we're not shutting down their economic systems. So I have become a lobbyist because of it, and I work on behalf of CARE. Mm-hmm. And I walk in and out of congressional offices in D.C. and all over the country just talking about, you know, why this law doesn't make sense and why we need to change it. And we've had minor strides. You know, they've given some funding to start programs where you can they give vouchers out, which is the most effective thing to do because you're keeping the economy rolling in those regions and you're getting the food where it's needed faster. But when you do this kind of work, you kind of have to have tunnel vision.
Yeah.
You have to know that you're planting a tree that you're probably never going to sit under its shade, right? But hopefully your children will and their children will. So it can be disheartening at times, but you can't stop doing the work that you know you're passionate about. And for me, it's even more personal because of my son. Ethan was 2.5 when I held him in my arms for the first time, and he was 16 pounds. 16 pounds. Wow. At 2.5 years of age. Distended belly. Mm-hmm. I mean, just completely malnourished. He was in an orphanage from the day he was born till the day I had the fortune to hold my son in my hand. And I know, I've seen what malnutrition does to a child, but I've also seen how it can be reversed. And how through proper nutrition and proper care, a child can thrive. I mean, I have a thriving 13-year-old today who, you know, is as healthy as a 13-year-old can be. So it's personal to me because I've seen the changes that, you know, minimal effort can make. I'll give you an example of, I went to Peru with CARE, and this particular region in Ayacucho, Peru, had 70% malnutrition rate among the kids. If you saw the babies, you know, they're chubby cheeks, and but their only source of food is potatoes, right? So there is food source, but it's malnutrition because it's not the proper food source. They had a huge deficit of protein in their diet. So these NGO companies give these microloans to the local women, $100 microloans, and they start raising guinea pigs, high in protein. They're actually really delicious. It's a rodent just like a rabbit is, so it tastes mm-hmm. very much like rabbit.
And easy to produce.
Very yeah. easy to produce. They eat alfalfa sprouts, which you can grow right mm-hmm. in your kitchen. And these models became not just protein sources for their families, but they were now taking this cuy guinea pig to market, and they were actually having financial success through a $100 microloan.
Wow.
But the malnutrition rate, just from that one program being instituted, where women were given microloans, in 4 years, the malnutrition rate in that region went down from 70% to 25%.
Wow.
Right? So there's so many things that are doable, that tangible change can be made with common sense solutions,
mm-hmm.
Which also then empower women in communities, which is the most important thing when it comes to eradicating hunger. educating our girls, empowering our women is, I believe, one of the biggest tools that we can have to eradicate hunger in our lifetime. Because when you empower a woman with something as minimal as a $100 microloan, she has three things that are her focus: a roof on her children's head, food on the table, and education. She single-handedly breaks the poverty cycle for the next generation. So it's so, so important to make sure that the women of our world are empowered. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's passionate work for me.
Where do you get your power?
For a long time, I thought that to make change happen, I needed to have money. That the only way you can make change happen is, so I would say, you know, I'm going to amass a lot of wealth and then I'm going to give it all away. Well, that didn't happen. So then I think the turning point for me was I realized that my voice was very powerful. Mm. And that using my voice was the most important thing I could do. Speaking up for the causes that I believed in was what mattered the most, bringing attention and focus to issues that mattered. And so my power is my voice. Mm.
Amazing. How much of your time does your lobbying work, you know, take up in your life?
30%.
Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
But I love it. Mm-hmm. I've seen tangible change. I've been disappointed. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, you have to have tunnel vision.
Yeah.
But I've seen tangible change happen. And I really love CARE as an organization. They're in 90 countries. And they've done tremendous work. And most of their work revolves around women's and girls' empowerment.
Yeah.
It's very near and dear to me.
Amazing. And do you, I mean, that phrase you use, and I've heard you say it before about, you know, planting trees whose shade you probably will never sit under. Where do you get the, or I'll rephrase that. What keeps you going in that type of work when you're not seeing, you know, day-to-day maybe results or something you can, you know, touch with your own hands? What keeps you going?
My son.
Your son. What does he think of your lobbying work? Like when you go to D.C., is he just like, see you later? Or
you know, I've had to miss, like I couldn't be at his graduation last year because I was in D.C. But you know, I tell him that I'm doing this so that tomorrow is better, not just for you, but for
so he knows what you're doing when you go.
He does, yes. And I think he appreciates it today. And I feel that we, in the world that we live in today, it's so important to make our children realize, and that's what a lot of immigrant parents did not do in the past, which has obviously turned out to our disadvantage, is that we didn't encourage our children to be part of the political process in this country. And so at least I'm hoping this generation, we teach our children, I teach my son every day that public service is an option that he should seriously consider. Mm-hmm. And that is a role in some form or shape, whether not just voting, you know, but supporting a candidate financially and mm-hmm. otherwise. But also, maybe you want to become a voice, right? Mm-hmm. And we have not taught our children that this is an option and this is a path that they can take. So I think to immigrant parents, teach your children every day not just to be part of the political process of going to vote, but becoming the people that people are voting for.
Yeah. Ethan for president.
He won't be able to be that because he wasn't born in this country, but there's so many other things he can do, right?
Amazing. Yeah. Well, he must be really proud.
He's a good kid.
Yeah.
I got very lucky.
Yeah.
He's a really, really stellar young man.
Yeah. That's awesome. Can I ask you one more question just to wrap up? Just my favorite question to ask everyone, which is, what was your favorite food when you were growing up?
So, and Ethan asked me this yesterday.
He's I was like, to say, you look really prepared for this answer.
And he was like, really? So there is plain steamed rice.
Okay. What kind of rice?
This rice that goes in Kerala. It's called Chambavari. It's a red rice sambar, which is a lentil soup, spicy lentil soup, and fried fish. Mm. But it has to be all together.
All together.
Yes.
Like in one bowl.
In one bowl.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that to you, it's, what do you feel when you eat that now?
It's my childhood. It's, yeah. I grew up on the beach. I woke up to the sound of fishermen pulling in their nets in the morning at 5 o'clock. You know, they chant when they pull it in because it's hard work pulling in those nets that they put out all night. And so I woke up to the lull of that music wow. every morning. And then the fishermen's wives in the afternoon would bring the fish to the different houses, and you would, you know, literally eat fish that came out of the ocean that morning. And so for me, it's the nostalgia, and, you know, it was a very charmed childhood. Just the memory of all of that and the ocean that I grew up on.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank
I really
you
appreciate your
for
time.
Having me do this.
Yeah. Before we get into our listeners' questions, a quick word about OXO, who helped make this episode possible. Why do I have so many OXO tools in my kitchen? Because I trust them and they're reliable. They help my work as a cookbook author be dependable and accurate, and they help my time as a home cook feel much more relaxed. I appreciate OXO's commitment to make every day better, every day. They approach their tools just like I approach my recipes. They notice things and solve problems and see opportunities to improve the process all of the time. Like their angled measuring cups, they allow you to see how much is in them even while they're sitting on your counter, which is so useful. Thanks, OXO, for supporting Keep Calm and Cook On. Want to check out OXO's products? Just head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. And now it's time for listeners' questions. If you have a question for me, you can just send me a DM on Instagram at Turshen, T-U-R-S-H-E-N, my last name and my handle, or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. One word, no punctuation. And guess who's here?
Hi, Julia. Are you ready for a question?
I'm ready.
Okay, your first question comes from Joanna via email, who asks, chickpeas are such a popular addition to recipes, but for those of us who are allergic to them, could you please suggest a good replacement? She is also allergic to soybeans, so if you could suggest another bean, that would be great.
Okay, I have a few ideas for replacements. The most convenient is just any type of canned white bean. So I'm thinking like a navy bean, a cannellini bean. You can use those pretty interchangeably in any kind of chickpea recipe. Another idea is to use frozen lima beans. I think a very not celebrated ingredient, really useful. So another replacement idea, and I'm thinking along the lines of recipes that use dried chickpeas that you'd soak and then grind to make something like falafel or then cook for hummus or something like that. I would consider trying dried fava beans. I think the texture and flavor are kind of similar. And also, if you're looking for a substitution for a chickpea recipe that has kind of, you know, that nutty flavor in a bean salad or something, try black-eyed peas. They're awesome.
Your next question comes from Laura B. 1226. Laura has two kids under the age of 3, a partner who works 12 hours a day, and is also a stay-at-home parent. Could you suggest some cozy meals that include protein and veggies that Laura can make to keep everybody happy?
So the first thing off the top of my head is the Italian flag baked pasta from Now and Again, which is my most recent cookbook. It is so easy and so delicious, and everyone loves it, everyone of, you know, every age. And you basically make it by making a really easy meat sauce with ground turkey. Again, could be any ground meat, you know, very flexible recipe. And then you mix that with frozen spinach and creme fraiche. You could also use sour cream, just something to make it a little bit creamy. You mix that with pasta, you bake it. You can make the whole thing ahead of time and just heat it up before everyone sits down. And it's just so comforting and so good. There's also a recipe in the book for roasted tomato and chicken enchiladas that are also kind of like a crowd favorite. Make it ahead, warm it up in the oven, you know, super, super just friendly and cozy. And that served with like a really easy salad, like romaine and sliced avocado, put some lime juice and olive oil. That would be great. Enchiladas also have me thinking of a big pot of rice, white rice, brown rice, whatever. Some black beans, use canned ones, no problem. Dice a few avocados, and then maybe roast a bunch of cherry tomatoes on a sheet pan, just olive oil and salt. And then everyone can mix and match those. And that's a really great and easy and affordable meal.
Next question comes from Lucy Condalora, who would like to know, what do you think is the best cookware investment for a new or young cook?
I would say a couple of stainless steel sheet pans. I think they're so useful and so versatile in the kitchen. They don't cost a lot of money. You can get them in a restaurant supply store. And the other thing is a really good knife. With a, you know, a good solid sharp knife, everything in the kitchen is a lot easier. The one I use, it's called a Misono 440, which sounds really fancy. I think it cost me about $100. Actually, it cost you, Grace, that, because you got it for me as a gift. But you can get even more affordable ones also from a restaurant supply store. You don't have to spend a fortune to get a good knife, just something that will, you know, hold a sharp blade and feel comfortable in your hand. And that can mean a different thing for each person.
Jody Ray Dula would like to know about bechamel. Jody says, bechamel intimidates me. Can we talk about it? Because she would like to make moussaka.
I love moussaka. I haven't had it in so long. So bechamel, I think, intimidates a lot of people. So yeah, we can talk about it. What it is basically a mixture of fat and flour that are cooked together, usually butter and flour, and then you add liquid to it to make a really thick, almost gravy-like mixture. And bechamel is usually milk. But if you added, you know, stock to that fat and flour mixture, you'd get the base of gravy, of gumbo, you know, all these wonderful things. So a few tricks to making it. One is to warm the liquid before you add it to that fat and flour. It will incorporate a lot easier if it's not cold. And another thing to keep in mind is to add it really slowly and to whisk the whole time while you add it. That will keep you from getting, you know, bumps in, on the road. And also keep in mind, if you add a bunch of grated cheese to bechamel, you'd get the most delicious cheese sauce and you're on your way to macaroni and cheese. Always worth mentioning. Honestly, the best trick is to kind of forget about bechamel and just use creme fraiche. I do it all the time in my recipes. I think it's just the easiest thing. And creme fraiche is basically like French sour cream, which just means it's sour cream that has an even higher fat amount in it. So it's super delicious and it does all the work of bechamel with none of the work.
Your next question comes from Matt H40, who says, I love seeing your posts about giving back. What inspired you to start?
That's so kind. Thanks, Matt. So giving back was instilled in me, I would say, from a pretty young age. It was a really big part of the high school I went to. It was a major sort of tenet of the school, sort of community service and volunteering. And ever since then, I've always done it wherever I've lived, whatever community I'm in. And Grace and I got really involved once we moved outside of the city. And it was a great way for us to meet people. And I always like to mention that the way we found where we volunteer was basically a really quick Google search of our zip code and the word volunteer. It might sound really obvious and basic, but it was a great way to find it. Thanks so much, Grace. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
And if you have a question you'd like to hear Grace ask and hear me answer, just send a DM to me on Instagram at Turshen, T-U-R-S-H-E-N, or email keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. That's one word, no punctuation. Thanks for listening to Keep Calm and Cook On. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate and review the show. It really makes a difference to help others find it. Also, tell a friend or a family member. Text your mom or your cousin or your old roommate. Let them know. Also, if you have a cooking question that you'd like to hear me answer, just drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. One word, no punctuation. That's keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. For more information about me and the show, head over to juliaturshen.com. Everything about my work is there, and if you click on Keep Calm and Cook On, you'll find everything about the show. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Turshen, which is just my last name. Thanks again to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. And before I really say goodbye, I just wanted to take a second to shout out CARE, the organization that Asha is an ambassador for. CARE's mission is to work around the globe to save lives, defeat poverty, and achieve social justice.
They do this work in a number of ways, including empowering girls and women, empowering farmers, and increasing access to life-saving medicine, food, and more. To learn more about CARE and the work they do, the work that ASHA's advocacy helped to support, head over to care.org. Thanks again for listening to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'll catch you next time.